Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. Last week, Dr. Manisha Sinha discussed the legacy of Frederick Douglass and other abolitionists from her book, The Slave's Cause, A History of Abolition. This week, we hit the funny pages and talk about the anthology The Peanuts Papers with editor Andrew Blonner, contributing artist Chris Ware, and cartoonist Ivan Brunetti, who honor the legacy of Charles Schulz and his iconic Peanuts comic strip. This conversation was recorded November 4th, 2019, live at the American Writers Museum. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
We're here to celebrate Charlie, Linus, Lucy, Snoopy, Woodstock, Pigpen, and the rest of the gang. Charles Schulz and Peanuts have done what we at the American Writers Museum believe the best of our writers do. They make us look not just at their characters, but at ourselves, and come away from the experience profoundly changed. Schulz began drawing Peanuts in 1950, and when he announced his retirement in December 1999, the Peanuts comic strip was syndicated in more than 2,600 newspapers, with book collections translated in more than 25 languages. Schulz was awarded the highest honors from his fellow cartoonists, received Emmy Awards for his animated specials, was recognized and lauded by the U.S. and foreign governments, had NASA spacecraft named after his characters, and inspired a concert performance at Carnegie Hall. Not bad for a boy and his dog. Here to talk with us tonight about the Peanuts Papers anthology from the Library of America are its editor, Andrew Blonner, and contributing artists and writers Chris Ware and Ivan Brunetti.
Felt a little bit standing up there like the NFL pregame, NFL on Fox pregame.
Yeah, sure. Right.
Thank you for that introduction. Thank you to this museum. I'm supposed to be a jaded New Yorker who's not awed by things, but this place is awesome. So anyone who's maybe watching this online, whether you live in Chicago or not, I would urge you to make it your business to get here. Second, a big thanks to Chris and Ivan, of course, for being here, to Library of America, in my view, the best publisher in the country. And I strongly encourage you to seek out their all of their books. And a big thank you to all of you. I know there are a lot of things that contend for your time every night, so we appreciate you being here. And I'm glad that you covered a lot of that history and statistics to do with Peanuts, because there's an awful lot of it. I sort of want to get into this sort of a gateway by asking, you know, it begs the question, are we in a new Peanuts moment? Because as of November 1st, Apple TV started a new Peanuts show, Snoopy in Space. At the Thanksgiving Day parade, later this month in New York, there's going to be a new Snoopy float. Come the beginning of the new year, there's going to be a new national tour of You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, which I only learned in the process of putting this book together is the most produced musical in American history. And if you had to guess the number of productions, I'm going to guess you couldn't even come close to guessing that it's 40,000 that is employed, if that's the right word, about 250,000
people. I still have never seen it.
That's a big admission.
I feel bad.
So we have a lot to cover, but I just want to throw this out to you guys first. You know, is this a new moment? Chris, in your piece, you talk about sort of it's not a coincidence that maybe Fred Rogers and Charles Schulz are having sort of a renaissance. But has it just been sort of one 70-year love affair with Peanuts? Or is there something that's contributing now that's engendering kind of a new affection and attention for it? I want to hear both of you guys on that.
Well, I think in my own case, and probably pretty much everybody in this room, it's been a perpetual Peanuts moment for our entire lives, because Charles Schulz created these characters that are alive in our minds, even though he died 20 years ago. I mean, I still think about them, I think, pretty much every day. And, I mean, granted, I'm a cartoonist, so I've already got something wrong with me, but I think everybody in this room, with the exception of this nice girl, Elizabeth, over here, who was born after Charles Schulz's death, but is obviously very inclined to the character. She brought Snoopy and Charlie Brown with her and is wearing a Lucy dress, which is great to see. Schulz is communicating something to people who weren't even born yet when when he, which is pretty incredible, actually, which is the real test of art. So I'm going to start some images here so you don't have to look at my head the whole time. You've got two other heads to choose from, but then you'll have some pictures, too. So,
well, I was just to second that. I'm not really that much aware of what's going on, so I didn't know if there was a moment. As you said, basically, that's been my entire life. Charles Schulz was the biggest influence on everything I do as a cartoonist. So he's in my bloodstream at this point, you know, so I can't conceive of a world without it. But it's great to hear that in the outside of my reality, or what you guys call reality, outside of my head, that there is a resurgence happening.
I want to mention that the two of these, you know, put these programs together, and sometimes the chemistry is just not there because the people don't know each other or it just doesn't jive. I only learned after the fact that you two guys not only know each other, but have had dinner together every Sunday night faithfully for the last 20 years.
Yeah. It's true, actually. Yeah. Even from, I actually was trying to remember the night, the Sunday that would have corresponded with the death of Schulz. That must have been the number one topic across the burrito table that night. But I actually don't remember it at all. Do you remember it?
No, well, again, this has been a continuous stream of these Sunday dinners, so it's hard to even put things in the timeline. But all I know is that you've seen so much taco sauce on my shirt over the years. Like, probably make a mound this high on the table. So,
yeah. Well, it's funny. If it's been 20 years, that makes it 1999, which mm-hmm. happens to have been the year that I got to meet Schulz, which I knew it was a special, surreal thing that was happening at the time, but I didn't realize just how much so. And the quick backstory there is, I'm a literary agent. I represent other writers and their books generally. And a guy I worked with, Bob Blauner, actually no relation, was putting together his own anthology about men writing essays about the death of their mothers and the grief of men. It's called Our Mother's Spirits. And right around that time, I saw Schulz on his A&E biography. You know, and he was sort of, not notoriously, but sort of famously stoic and kind of not outwardly emotional. But when he got on the subject of talking about his mom, it was deep and it was heavy and it was profound. And it engendered something for me to want to write to him on Bob's behalf just to see if there was any chance he'd consider contributing to that book. And I thought at best I'd get back a nice form letter. It was before the internet, at least it was for me. And instead, I get a note saying, declining as politely as possible the invitation to write for that other book, but saying, if you ever find yourself in Santa Rosa, California, stop by. I'd love to meet. And I thought, if that's a bluff, I'm calling it. I happen to have a little redheaded girlfriend at the time, and I said, how would you feel about planning a trip to Napa Valley and going out to the... So there it was in his office, and wow, he could not have been kinder, more generous, thoughtful, sensitive. And this book is an anthology, and I, along the way I looked up the word anthology comes from a Latin word, I think, meaning bouquet. So this book really is a bouquet to Charles Schulz and the world and the characters he created. But about these two guys... not only have they been having dinner every Sunday night for 20 years, their two pieces that are in this book were published as excerpts in arguably the two most august literary publications in the country, if not the world, Chris's by the New Yorker and Ivan's by the Paris Review. And there's just a clear, palpable, mutual admiration between you guys. And one of the things, I'd read each of your pieces multiple times during the process of this book coming together, but it was only very recently I read them back to back. And what came through sort of palpably and concretely were two things. One, how much in general, what a shared sensibility you have, and what a very clear, strong sense you have, not just of your own gratitude to Charles Schulz, but a sense that all cartoonists and maybe beyond that should have toward Schulz. And the second thing was how much you both identified very strongly with Charlie Brown. So I wonder if you could talk about, take your pick of either of those things.
You want to go first?
It would be impossible to explain it. I just, from the first time I read Peanuts, which I must have been 8 or 9 years old. That's when I came to America from Italy, and that was one of the first American comics that I read. I actually was not familiar with Peanuts before that, but I just instantly connected with Charlie Brown. I guess I was picked on a lot at school, but I had this completely unwarranted or unearned kind of optimism about things that Charlie Brown has. He kind of can still delude himself and have that hope. But I think I connected with that because you don't, when you're a kid getting picked on, you don't want to really accept that reality that you're at the bottom of the social order, you know. So I just really connected with the character and his outlook on things, which is pessimistic but kind of weirdly optimistic at times.
In my own case, as I said in my essay, I was so moved and upset by the fact that Charlie Brown never got any Valentines that I made him a Valentine, and I told my mom to send it to him. And that I felt like I had an in because my mom was a newspaper editor, and my grandfather was actually the editor of the paper, managing editor of the paper before that. So I thought, he's going to get it. He's definitely going to get it. But it turns out Chip told me, Chip Kidd, who did the cover for the book and has done 2 different books on Peanuts, he said, oh, yeah, thousands of kids sent Schultz Valentine's to Charlie Brown. So I should say they sent Charlie Brown Valentine's because, right, you know, I knew that I was sending a Valentine to a drawing, but I still knew somehow that it was going to make me feel better if I did, because there was something every time I saw that Charlie Brown wasn't going to get a Valentine, it made me feel horrible, and I just wanted to make myself and hopefully him feel better. So Schultz really has had a power in his drawing and his ability to get right into the human heart, I think, better than any other cartoonist. So, and he's passed that down to our generation. So I don't think graphic novels would be what they are now. Like what we try to do in longer books would not exist without Schultz figuring out a way of getting into a character on the page and then having it come back out into the reader's mind and circle through the heart that way.
Ivan, your piece is called Yesterday Will Get Better, right?
Yes.
Can you maybe just explain that title a little bit or contextualize that?
I must have gotten that from a strip, but I just it's stuck in my head. I was looking for things to connect to it, and I guess that's kind of my philosophy of life too, because I ruminate a lot. So, but I keep thinking that somehow it's going to change the past. Actually, I think we're all doing that as cartoonists by drawing about it. You're sort of, it's not just reliving it. And I think that was part of Schultz's genius too, that he was in the moment of like whatever he was drawing based on his memory of childhood or whatever was going on. He could kind of relive it as he's drawing it. And it's so vivid and real. It really does jump off the page. But I think we're all, maybe not every cartoonist, but it feels like kind of that's what we're doing, is revisiting this past and maybe changing it or overcoming it or whatever, however you want to look at it.
Yeah, I mean, I think Schultz clearly, when you find out after reading David Michaelis's biography, you realize that, like, all of the details of the strip are based on Schultz's life. Like, he worked with a Linus Maurer at the art instruction schools. He worked with somebody named Charlie Brown at the art instruction schools. There was a preacher named Charles E. Brown. He had a friend when he was a kid named Charlie E. Brown, I believe. And it runs through his strip so personally that sitting at that table every day of his life, he was going over these slights and wrongs that he felt that he'd experienced as a kid and trying somehow to make them right, I think. And I mean, I certainly identify with that. I know Ivan identifies with it. We talk about it all the time. The younger cartoonists don't as much, and it really makes me mad. And they're so well-adjusted. I don't know, like, even my daughter, she's 14 years old, and she's so happy and well-adjusted. My wife said the other night, she's like, how this isn't fair. You know, like, well, how did she get to be so happy? When I was 14, I was miserable, so.
Well, it's funny. Picking up on that point, did an event at the New Yorker Festival a few weeks back, and the question to do with this project, and the question came up of whether Peanuts is quote-unquote dark, and not to put words in your mouth, but I think you're kind of it's not mutually exclusive, but I think you, your focus was more that it was real. Is that accurate?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I read it, when I read it, I felt like these, this represent, not only were the events real and honest, it felt like life. It felt like the indignities and the uncertainties and the sort of violence, really, that life can inflict on you felt honest to me in a way that other things on television didn't. And on top of that, the characters especially, that's the most important part. They feel more real almost than real people. Like, they existed for me. When I opened up those paperbacks and dove into them, those little drawings came alive to me in a way, and they were my friends. And I know that Clifford Thompson said the same thing. It's just, and I think everybody in this room probably feels the same way a little bit, more or less. Like, you read Peanuts and you had that feeling like, yeah, these people, these little figures on the page are real. So
they're real. And would you say, I mean, you use the word that the genius, you say that you write that the genius of Peanuts is that it seems simple and replicable.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that when I was younger, like, I could copy this because there's just a few lines. There's often not even like a lot of backgrounds to draw. It's very, it feels like it's minimal until you really try to copy it. And there's something that really is like, it's beyond forging somebody's handwriting. You know, because they also, it's not just the visual look of it, but the totality of it together. I think it's impossible. You'd have to be Charles Schulz to do it. I think that's part of the genius of it. No one else could do that.
Is that a genius? And also for people who do what you, was it also frustrating because it seems so accessible and doable? I mean, I think there are people, the last book I did put together was about the Beatles. And I think a lot of people grew up thinking, I could play the chords and hit the notes, and then you try, and you just, especially when it's John and Paul harmonizing, it sounds like one voice, and you're trying to make your one, your voice sound like two. But in this case, was it actually frustrating, or?
It was just humbling, you know. Humbling. But it just helped me appreciate it even more. I knew I liked it, but then I think maybe I read things in the past with some cartoonists, not belittling Schulz, but kind of talking about, oh, it's really simple, or. I just think there's more to it, and it's not so easy to not even replicate it visually, but there's more to cartooning than just the surface of it. And I don't know.
Well, like his lines, like you said, even I think you quoted this about him drawing Linus and how the pen splays out. Like, it's a record of the way his hand moves, and the way his hand not only moves, but the way his hand is connected to his mind and to his heart and to his eyes, and how that hand and all of those things changed in 50 years. Like, you look at Charlie Brown in 1950, he's completely unrecognizable if you put it next to the Charlie Brown of 1999. But if you watch him slowly change, it makes sense. But still, it's the same thing that was in Schulz that he transmogrified onto that page that then you feel. You see it with your eye, and you feel that drawing in a way that I don't really think there's any other medium where we're asked to read a picture other than comics. And Schulz was by far the most literate of picture makers I think there ever has been. So,
well, that's interesting, too, because I've heard you talk a little bit about this, the trajectory of Charlie Brown, and some historians think that the turning point, maybe some think for better or for worse, for the whole strip, for the 50 years, was when Schulz put Snoopy up on 2 feet and stopped having him just be a dog crawling around on all fours. But do we see that in the other characters as well?
You mean when they...
Like, that there was a big change, the way you're talking about that Charlie Brown in those 50 years. I mean, with Linus and Lucy, I mean, do we see...
Because they were a little
both
younger.
Talk about how there's time doesn't change in the strip, like that they don't get older.
It is strange, Chris was saying... thinking about Charlie Brown in 1950 and in 1999, if you see them right next to each other, they're such different drawings, but it's almost like looking at a baby picture of yourself and then a picture of somebody that's 50 or older or whatever, but you can still see that it's the same person, and that's kind of amazing. I don't think the characters aged very much in the strip, but it's almost like they did age on some other level, you know.
It's like Sally, Linus, and Lucy aged. Lucy started out as a little baby. Schulz didn't know what to do with her. But the second that she, at least according to David Michaelis, became a stand-in for his wife, then she like lit up on the page. she started dominating the strip, and then, you know, he could really pour himself into it. So I think, I mean, Charlie Brown for the first couple of years of the strip was almost sort of a weird, you mentioned optimism, but I think he was sort of like a, not a morose character, certainly the way he became. And then later in the strip, he became almost sort of a cipher, almost kind of a quiet, somber character, kind of like a, I wouldn't even know how to describe him, but he did, except with the football and kite. Oh boy, sorry, it's probably my wife. She always calls me when I'm...
Schultz's ghost. Sorry.
Yeah. He became more just kind of calm or something, I think, maybe. I don't know. I think that's more of like an older cartoonist thing. So the strip, and I think Schultz even said later, he said, I did things in the 1950s that I would never do now. Like, he felt that it was way too spiteful, way too angry, way too violent. And of course, that's why it's so exciting to read, because it's, you know, the emotional violence on the page is just so, you know, wow, you can't believe he's saying that. But it still at the same time feels so innocent and warm, strange.
I mean, it's an, you raise a point, 1950 versus 2000 versus today. I mean, the culture of society is so much more polarized now. I mean, to me, it begs the other question of, well, number one, how do you really explain the transcendence, the universal appeal over such a long period of time? And two, could such a thing happen today, or does it exist in any way, shape, or form in the culture?
You can handle that one.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, maybe it does somewhere. I mean, you mentioned earlier Fred Rogers, and I really feel like Schultz and Rogers were sort of similar people in a way. And in this moment now, where we've got not only a bullying president, but we've got a bullying media, the internet. That's what the internet is. It's just a giant four-dimensional bully. It takes everything and converts it to the absolute black or white ends of the spectrum and allows for no humanity to come into it, even though, of course, all of the software developers who created it told us, like, oh, it's going to bring people together. You know, the opposite thing seems to be happening. So I think that Schultz and Fred Rogers especially were men who provided an example of how to be a man who's not a jerk, and how to be a good father, and how to be a good person. And in a way that transcends irony and transcends criticism. Like, you can't really make fun of either of them. It doesn't really make sense. It's like talking about Beethoven being entertaining or something. It just simply doesn't apply. So, I don't know.
I really can't add anything to
that. Okay, sorry.
That's really good. Okay. So this is our Sunday night. So like, Chris has all the good ideas. And
that's
not
true.
That's really great. I'm going to steal that somewhere. But
well, not to bury a lead here, but it did invite one other person to participate in this. Somebody who couldn't be here but did write about the subject elsewhere, and I want to read what he wrote, and maybe you can divine who it is. It's another local person. Like millions of Americans, I grew up with Peanuts, but I never outgrew it. Wherever I lived, wherever I traveled, I could find those three or four panels in the paper each morning. And Charlie, Snoopy, it's weird to hear Charlie. It's always this Charlie Brown, right? Charlie, Snoopy, Linus, Lucy, Franklin, and the gang brought childhood rushing back. That's what made Charles Schultz so brilliant. He treated childhood with all the poignant and tender complexity it deserves. He gave voice to all its joys and anxieties. He explored the emotions that we too often forget kids feel until we're reminded that we once felt them ourselves. Hope, doubt, the exquisite pain of unrequited love, the self-exploration of what it means to be different, the comfortable knowledge that it's all going to be okay, even if Lucy's advice isn't very good. For decades, Peanuts was our own daily security blanket. That's what makes it an American treasure. In his final strip, Schultz wondered how he could ever forget the Peanuts gang, and the rest of us never will. And we can share our love for the gang with our children and our grandchildren for decades to come. Anyone know who wrote that? No?
Good guess.
Barack Obama.
That's right.
Who had the audacity not to show up tonight, despite the invitation.
I would say he'd be the third example of somebody how to be a good...
That's what triggered it. That's,
yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, it's a surprise to a lot of people, and I don't know this for a fact, but I've been told that Schultz was a lifelong Republican, actually.
This is true, yeah.
And that he told Monty, one of his sons, that one of his regrets was not voting for Kennedy in 1960. But he was friends with Reagan. Reagan's favorite part of Peanuts was Lucy pulling the football away. But Clinton and others, we're not going to talk about presidential politics
anymore. I think that's just said it all, though, as a metaphor. Pulling the football away, well, pulling our future away from America.
Well, I mean, whether it's Lucy and the football or Linus and the pumpkin patch, I mean, people seem to be divided. Whether it's a manifestation of an inspiring kind of resilience and perseverance and hope and faith, or something very different. Do you have a view on that?
I don't know. I mean. No, I don't. I'm going
to
give that.
Maybe he was just trying to figure it out himself. What faith was, you know, but there's some aspect of it that it's not rational, and all the evidence is to the contrary. But people still, I don't know. Maybe he was just trying to figure it out. I think the whole strip is him trying to figure himself out and his life out in some way. So.
You know, I did mention this in the essay too. That Art Spiegelman said to me once that he felt that Schultz. Broke himself into little pieces and then just let them go at each other for 50 years on the page. Basically, that's the example of, like, really what Peanuts is Charles Schultz battling with himself on the newspaper page every single day, and, you know, 300 million people read it or something. As to the matter of faith, actually, he was a devout member of the Church of God in Minneapolis, and then when he moved to California, there was no Church of God. But he ended up then going to the Methodist Church. But then later in life, he sort of withdrew from that and became what he called a secular humanist. If not only, I think he kind of even questioned all of that stuff after. But he was still very generous and devout. He gave his second house, bequeathed it to the church, and tithed tons and tons of money. I'm sure they were sad to see him go. So,
Ivan, in your piece, Ivan, you wrote about Chris. You say he articulated quite eloquently the difference between drawing and drawing comics. Can you explain?
Yeah, I mean, Chris, you've talked about this. Really should let you answer it, but I don't think I fully understood that. You know, the first time I might have read that in an interview or something where you said that, but until you actually draw and draw comics, you start to see what the difference is. And in Peanuts, I mean, a lot of it, if you judge it as drawing, you have to use different criteria for how the drawing is used, because it's sort of a calligraphy, and there are forms, and the characters sort of have a three-dimensional quality to them. But, I mean, it's really kind of, in some ways, it is flat shapes. And the mystery of it, I don't know if anyone can explain it, but to me, comics is kind of like alchemy more than science. Like, I don't know why those things come alive any more than I understand why letters become words, you know, and then become even more complex words and concepts. Comics operate that same way. I'm sure there's a scientist that can explain it better than I can, but I like to think of it as a sort of mysterious kind of process, and that, I mean, the whole point of doing it is to surprise yourself when you're doing it. I think if you're not surprised by what you're creating in some way, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant surprise, it's probably not going to be that compelling a comic strip.
Oh, shit.
You know, but I don't know if you could break it down, and I don't even know if I want to. You know, I kind of like delving into it and not being able to fully understand it and just kind of going with it. I don't know. I don't understand breathing either, but like, luckily my body knows to do it, because if it were left up to me, I'd probably forget.
Well, actually, there's just a coincidence with what Ivan was saying here. Comics are the art that allows drawings to come alive on the page in your mind. Like, if you look at this particular strip here, Peppermint Patty and Snoopy and Woodstock, they're drawings, but when you read them, they come alive. You go left to right. And if you notice, there's no words on this except for Schultz signed it over to a friend of his. But if you read it, you'll hear sounds in your mind. And I come to think of that as what I call the music of comics. And that music is that sort of strange internal rhythm that we all experience when we're meeting people or talking to them, watching them move their hands away. I'm moving my hands right now and trying to decode if what they're saying is actually true or not. And I think Tolstoy was probably the writer who most effectively encoded that into his writing. He captured that rhythm of life into his actual prose. And I think Schultz, as a cartoonist, captured that electricity of actual movement in human life better than any other cartoonist. So,
well, Chris, you wrote, we don't just look at characters, we quote-unquote read them. Like, what do you mean we read them like musical notes?
Well, sort of like what I just said. They are like letters on a page. You use the same mechanisms of consciousness and apprehension in reading a comic strip that you do in reading a line of text. You look through the pictures, but you also read them at the same time. You're not looking at them. You're seeing them, but you're actually reading the pictures themselves. So I don't really know how else to articulate it. I even called it alchemy. I think that's appropriate, but I'm not sure of much, but having sat at a table for 30 years doing this, I can say with 99.9% certainty that comics are an art of reading and reading pictures. You don't even need words in comics, but you're reading images.
So. Did you bring the one with the grown-ups in it?
I did, yeah. Do you want me to show some of those? Okay. So a lot of these pictures that I put together here are Schultz's family and all those. That very first picture there you saw was his dad's barber shop. His dad was a barber, and in the strip itself, sometimes Charlie Brown talks about going to his dad's barber shop, and how he feels like it's the best place on earth. Again, a very biographical detail. This is actually the building that the barber shop was in the corner of Snelling, and I forgot the other. Thank you. My goodness, there's a devotee here. You should just come up and. this is an apartment building. His was, you can see the arrow pointing to it there, that far right apartment. That's where Schultz lived in high school, and his dad's barbershop was down
below. I've actually been in there.
Oh, you went there. That's right. Yeah. I forgot. Yeah.
There's a brewery in the back now. There, it's not the barbershop anymore. So it's like a micro brew.
Of course, everything is now, but yeah.
They didn't let us in to the upstairs or anything. But I was really curious to see the neighborhood he grew up in, because it felt so much like the neighborhood I grew up in here in Chicago after when my family moved here. Mm-hmm. It felt comfortable, like the sidewalk squares were the correct size for me and stuff like that. Even when he left Minnesota, he was still drawing it. I don't know if he ever really drew California in the strip. I don't know, maybe.
Yeah, I guess you could maybe consider a ranch house or something like that, California. But I think you're right. I think he was always stuck in the seasons, especially. Like he always said, he really liked the seasons. I don't think it snowed a lot in Sebastopol, though. So he really reluctantly went to California. It was his first wife who really wanted to go out there. So, but his heart kind of remained in Minnesota, I think. And then she built this ice rink. Sort of Swiss-looking ice rink, I think, is a way of, making a little place where he could go and feel more Minnesotan, mm-hmm. and even decorated it with sort of Scandinavian details and stuff, and then she ended up running off with the contractor, so is this being broadcast? It is, oh no. So, anyway, life is complicated. So this is a weird... Schultz was always experimenting with the strips really early on in the 1950s. And in a really bizarre sequence, I think in 1954, he did this 5-week or 4-week story of Lucy going and competing in a golf tournament. Which is, probably everybody felt this like, oh, what? Just sort of like, okay... And, it's weird enough, but the weirdest part of it all is it's not a golf tournament with kids in it. It's a golf tournament with adults. And Schultz actually drew adults in the strips. So you can see in that second tier there, where the dialogue balloon is pointing to Charlie Brown and Lucy. There's actual adults following them, and then the lower panel there's adults in the background. They don't have faces. Clearly, Schultz, when he actually started to draw this, would realize, like, oh, my God, I've done something really that's not working here, but I'm going to try to see this through. And I think it made him really aware of the fact that his strip was something very much stranger than he realized it was. The strip was designed by the syndicate, basically, to save space. They sold it as a space saver strip, which Schultz found particularly unnerving and angering, because he felt he wanted to expand on the comics page, and he was given this tiny little space, and that's why it's called Peanuts. That's not his title. That was given by the syndicate, and he always felt it was very demeaning. But as he worked on the strip and tried to do these different things, he started to realize, I think, that the power in his strip was this sort of bizarre, strange little universe of just these little tiny kids acting like adults and somehow standing in for the feelings that we have inside of us. And I've quoted this before. There's Vladimir Nabokov has said that we all have children buried alive inside of us. So I think that's kind of what he was getting at here. What
in
I do?
The middle tier, mm-hmm. That's the left-hand panel. I mean, just looking at it, it looks so Frank King.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
I mean, huh. Just looking at that composition, I thought of Gasoline Alley, also Bruegel, but Gasoline Alley especially. And then the previous page in the center where they're really tiny silhouettes.
Yeah.
That's really strange.
It is.
The whole 50 years of Peanuts to see that view. He must have, like you said,
he was looking at Milton Caniff or something. He just was like, oh, I got to try this new fangled way of whatevering, you know, so.
Is this the period where you said it was as if the strip had the flu?
Yeah. Doesn't it feel like it? You look at it, you're just like, ugh. You know, it's just like when you have a fever and you have the same thought going over in your mind or something. So
Michael Jordan scored 37 with the flu, though.
Well, still, you can see Schultz really had cartooning chops here. It's a beautifully composed page, but he could see, I think, that it didn't work, really, so. Here's some other weird stuff Schultz did. He did Teenagers. He did this. He wasn't just doing Peanuts when he started out. He did two other strips. This was for a Catholic youth magazine, which is kind of unlikely. He was drawing panel cartoons about teenagers for a Christian magazine. You know, it's like, wow, that's kind of an interesting combination. So, but just to see these particular, like right there, it looks like Charlie Brown and Peppermint Patty in art school and like age 21 or something, you know? And again, talk about having the flu. This is like taking mescaline or something, you know? But they're great jokes, but they have weirdly Christian punchlines to them too. So he was channeling something that was very personal to him and taking it very seriously. What also surprised me here is how loose they are. I mean, these are actually
loose.
Like they're just really gesturally drawn, very quickly, much more quickly drawn than even Peanuts. I
think. Strip at the time. Yeah, what year were those?
I think it's 58, maybe something,
Do feel looser than the Peanuts strip at the time. Like the strip got loose like that, but I think later, mm-hmm. Maybe he was experimenting with his pen line or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, could it be anything? Like, maybe he was panicking. Like, 1954, you don't know that the strip's going to last 50 years. I mean, you hope that you do, but maybe he was trying to diversify. I think you're going to show the other weird strip. And maybe he was thinking, I got to have a backup plan here in case this goes south. Who knows?
I think at that point, he was doing pretty well financially. He was making, according to Michaelis, he was making twice the amount of the most highly paid college president at that time. But he still, I think a lot of this has to do with him feeling confined by the little tiny boxes of Peanuts and not realizing that that was actually the catalyst, the chemical catalyst to make that atomic bomb happen every day on the page for him. So, but he really, like this actually might have been inked by a guy named Jim Sassville, who was another person at the Art Instruction company in Minneapolis where Schultz was employed, and Schultz would do the loose drawing in pencil underneath and then Sassville would ink it. It's possible this is Schultz, but I'm not sure. It actually looks almost more like Hank Ketchum, who did Dennis the Menace. But you can see this is like Schultz being sort of like a typical cartoonist, and it helps you see the real weird power of Peanuts. You know, it kind of brings it a little bit more into focus. And why he wanted to do a Sunday page about bridge and games and tennis, it just seems like, okay, right on, whatever. Needless to say, it didn't last. So,
just to interject, for all of the trajectory and changes, and you're on record as saying Schultz is the only writer you've been reading your entire life. Is that right?
Yeah, I think, and probably everybody in this room could say the same thing. And I don't, you know, I don't read his early his work and think, oh, what wonderful kids strips or something. I read it and I think, oh my God, you know, he's telling me something about life now in the same way I felt that when I was a kid. I get different things out of it now than when I was a kid. And I cannot think of any other writer who has as much power as a kid's writer or a teenager writer or as a adult writer.
I mean, just while we were talking, this one strip came into my mind. I always kind of go back to it. It's the strip where Charlie Brown is talking about that feeling when you're a kid, and it's kind of weird because he's talking about it nostalgically as if he's not a child, but when you're in the backseat of your parents' car and you can fall asleep, and then you get to a certain age and you can't do that anymore because you understand, like, you know, your parents are human and might even be crazy or whatever. And then there's actually, it's kind of dangerous, you know, hurtling through space and time with that car. But it's so strange to me, like it's a child in the strip talking about something, this adult realization that probably everyone's had that moment in their life where they realize their parents were just human beings just trying to figure things out themselves. But when you're a kid, you don't think of it that way. You just, you can fall asleep in the back seat. And there's something about like wanting to go back to that, you know, that, that always stuck with me. I don't know. I was just for some reason thinking about that strip while we were talking.
It's like, man, that's really good. I forgot about that. So this is another odd thing as we're moving up in time as these characters are getting older and older. This turned up on the internet a few years ago and penciled up at the very top in the upper left-hand corner is the name Hagemeyer. And when I saw this, it was like, oh, my God, what was he? My immediate thought was like, okay, he was going to experiment, and instead of peanuts, he was going to run this without telling anybody. And there was going to be 60-year-old or 50-year-old people in peanuts with no warning at all. These things never ran. I don't know exactly what they were intended for, but he actually drew them in the pre-printed peanuts squares. So I don't know what he was thinking. The strip is actually named after a fellow Army sergeant who befriended him during the Second World War and almost was sort of a big brother for him. But my friend Jeet here, who's a comics writer and also writes for The Nation, documenting the collapse of our country right now, pointed out that, again, it's another strip with a domineering, bossy woman, which Schultz was both fascinated and kind of afraid of, I think. So, yeah, so I guess this is like Lucy, age 59 or something, after way too many donuts or something. So,
that's such a Chris Ware idea, though, like to have a strip that's just going along and then all of a sudden it's, you know, 50 years later, but with no explanation. You kind of did that in your book.
Well, the weird thing is actually, I don't mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead, yeah.
As Peanuts actually, when it was submitted to the syndicate, was a double-tiered strip. It was teenagers and children. And that was suggested by the syndicate, but then as they kind of messed with it on the page, they thought, oh, this doesn't work, it's kind of a mess. And they wiped out the teenager part. And what was left were the kids. So, I mean, that's an interesting idea. You know, and Elsa Schultz actually tried that again a little bit later to submit a strip as a double-tiered thing. So, but.
Well, speaking of trajectories, I've gone from wondering, how are you guys having dinner every night, every Sunday night for 20 years, to understanding much more about why you guys get along so well after this conversation. There's a lot of simpatico and shared sensibility. I know we have a lot more to get to. Maybe we can throw it open to some questions and can incorporate some.
I can. I have a couple of quick clips.
Yeah,
if
great.
You want. Does everybody want to leave here about like 5 minutes or so?
Yeah.
I won't show this. This just makes me laugh because it's a strip he wrote to a reader who told him to get rid of a character, and it showed the anger of being a cartoonist, and he drew the character with an axe in her head and said, okay, fine. You're just going to have the death of a child on your mind for the rest of your life. So he definitely had an edge to him. So I wanted to talk about Franklin because Franklin was admitted, it was created in 1968, shortly after the murder of Martin Luther King, and his response to letters from a reader who suggested you need to have African-American kids in the strip, and Schultz included him. The syndicate told him it wasn't working. They were getting letters from people in the South saying they were going to cancel the strip, saying that they didn't want Franklin sitting next to Charlie Brown or Peppermint Patty, and certainly not playing on a beach. There were not integrated beaches at this time. And Schultz said, okay, if you take him out, I'm quitting. And Franklin stayed.
Thank you, guys. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, hear from Gloria Edom, founder of the Well-Read Black Girl Book Club and editor of the essay anthology of the same name. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.